You're listening to Roads to Home. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Joe Fagan, and I'm here in studio with my producer, PK.
Joe, welcome back to studio. We're here for number 8.
Thank you, PK. It's always a pleasure. Let me ask you, do you play golf?
I did start playing golf, actually, over the last couple of years. I'm a pandemic golfer.
You're a pandemic golfer. What's a pandemic golfer?
That's someone who the only way to get out of the house for 2 years was to get out and play golf. So that's how I took advantage of it and started playing golf.
And where did you play?
I played at Francis Byrne. I played at Rock Spring, Hendrick, some of the county courses around here. All great courses, you know, just to start out playing on. And, you know, I think that's how we even came to this conversation, right? Is when I moved to town, one of the first things I noticed was there really are golf courses everywhere. And there must be a history of why in this area there are so many. And that's when I kind of came to you and was asking you even specifically about Rock Spring, the kind of history there. And there's plenty of history, right? You told me some of these golf courses weren't even golf courses from their existence.
That's so very true. Before I talk about that, what kind of golfer are you?
One that turns up on time.
Oh, that's good. That's an important thing.
Strokes and count beers.
That's important. You know, growing up in West Orange, I was a caddy, and my father actually was a caddy in the 1930s. Growing up, during the Depression, that was really one of the few employment opportunities that his generation had. And 1970s, I actually caddied at the Essex County Country Club for many years, and it was a great experience. But you know, West Orange is a little over 12 square miles, and at one time, this relatively small area featured 6 well manicured golf courses. And today, I want to talk about the town's first and oldest golf course that is now 136 years old. And what most people might not realize, or some do, is that it has moved from its original location, and it really only focused on the sport of golf as an afterthought. The peace and prosperity in the decades following the Civil War allowed Americans to discover leisure time. Obviously, during the Civil War, there wasn't much time for leisure time, but social gatherings soon focused on outdoor sports activities, and many clubs were formed to promote the special interests for their members. One of the very first sporting clubs to be founded in the Orange Mountains was the Montclair Esquerian Club. Did I say that word right?
I don't think so. Equestrian?
Equestrian Club. You know, sometimes I just like to test to see if people are really listening. But that was formed in 1876, about 11 years after the Civil War. And by 1880, it was known as the Montclair Hunt Club. Now, you're asking me, why are you talking about the Essex County Hunt Club? Well, the club quickly grew and became the center of social outings engaged in the sport of fox hunting. And these were gala events in the rural countryside surrounding West Orange, where they wore formal attire and sporting red coats and velvet hats. And another club devoted mostly to wintertime sports was the Essex County Toboggan Club, organized in 1885. As a matter of fact, if you know where the Luna Stage is on Valley Road, there's a marker, a historical marker across from the Luna Stage that is dedicated to the Essex County Toboggan Club. And it was in 1887 that the Essex County Hunt Club merged with the Essex County Toboggan Club to form the Essex County Country Club.
Does beg the question, was there any talk about hunting on toboggans?
No. The Toboggan Club was actually, it was actually a toboggan slide that ran parallel to current day Hazel Avenue. And they had this wooden slide, which was like a chute, and toboggans, the chute would be iced with snow, and it was a very slick surface, and they would ride toboggans down that.
Like a bobsled.
Like a bobsled, yeah. Like a bobsled. And it was, there was a clubhouse eventually built at the bottom, and it was actually featured in Harper's Weekly. It really never got its due as West Orange because it was always referred to at that time as the Orange Valley. The Orange Valley is kind of like the no man's land between Orange and West Orange. Some of it is in Orange. A lot of it is in West Orange. But it was the forming, merging of these two clubs in 1887 that formed the first Essex County Country Club. Now, PK, if you had to guess, you know, we're talking about golf here, and what would you think was the first banner sport of the newly formed Essex County Country Club in 1887?
So I'm guessing it's not golf.
It's not golf.
I'm going to say cricket.
Well, cricket, I think, is an English sport. Actually, polo was
polo. Okay.
Polo was very popular, sport, and that was the banner sport of the Essex County Country Club. As a matter of fact,
well, polo is kind of cricket on horses, though.
Actually, is what is cricket? Cricket is
where you take them wooden mallets. Oh, and the hit wooden mallets.
Yeah,
the
no, absolutely. Polo is cricket on horses. There was actually a polo field in West Orange that belonged to the Essex County Country Club, and it was at the corner of Mount Pleasant Avenue and Gregory Avenue. Now you're probably wondering where would they fit a polo field in there, and if you're judging it by today's standards, of course it wouldn't fit, but it's kind of like where the tennis courts are there now. Obviously, the polo field was a lot bigger than two tennis courts. But here's a little here's an interesting side note. It was during a polo match that a man got injured, and he had to be transported to the hospital, but there was no ambulance service. So by the time they actually got a horse and wagon to put this guy who was injured in the polo match and take him to the Orange Memorial Hospital, that actually caused some awareness in terms that there was a need for a ambulance service, and that gave birth to the record ambulance service in the Oranges, which actually almost operated for 100 years. But had it not been for this injury on that polo field in West Orange, I mean, it probably would have happened anyway, but that is what moved the process forward.
Not a safe sport.
No, especially if you don't have an ambulance service.
Or a horse.
Or a horse, yeah. No, a horse is definitely a requirement. But the first, I guess it was the late 1880s, maybe early 1890s, when polo kind of got phased out, and that's when they decided to switch from the banner sport of polo to golf. And the first Essex County Country Club was actually in Hutton Park off of Northfield Avenue. There was an 18-hole golf course all kind of in the area below Gregory Avenue. I have some maps of that golf course, and it's interesting to see how the holes are laid out. The clubhouse for the Essex County Country Club was the Orange Springs Hotel, which in 1840 became one of the first resorts in the Oranges because there was a mineral spring on the property that had great health benefits. If you go into the PNC Bank on Northfield Avenue, you'll see three murals. Now, we spoke about those murals before, but the one mural all the way to the left, the wall mural, depicts the Orange Springs Hotel. And that, when the Essex County Country Club built its golf course, that was its clubhouse and survived for many years. I believe it wasn't torn down to 1947, but the building itself. But after the Essex County Country Club, I guess it was around 1913 or so, where it actually moved from below Gregory Avenue to its current location on Prospect Avenue. And for a while, they actually operated both courses, but they eventually phased out the original golf course that gave birth to the Essex County Country Club as we know it today, where it's located on Prospect Avenue. And the other 18 holes, which is the Francis Byrne Golf Course that you mentioned earlier, where you've played at. How did you do when you played there, by the way?
Oh, not great, to be honest. I'm hoping with all of the renovations that they're doing, part of it is to make the holes bigger.
Well, that was the that became the public course, and that still exists today. And that is Francis Byrne. That's named after Brendan Byrne's father. Brendan Byrne was governor in New Jersey, who grew up in West Orange, and his father was a former commissioner, and that's who is the namesake of the Francis Byrne Golf Course.
Brendan Byrne, who had the stadium named after him.
Brendan Byrne, when the Meadowlands first opened, it was the Brendan Byrne Arena, where hockey and basketball, and certainly many concerts, were performed there. But yeah, Brendan Byrne was a West Orange boy.
So the land that the Essex County Country Club moved to, was that just farmland before?
Yeah, it was farmland. I don't know that it was open space. I don't know if there was any really farming done there.
Right.
But yeah,
privately owned property.
Yeah, that's correctly classified. It was privately owned property. But it was open space, and it was it eventually became the golf course, I think, in 1913. Also, there was a golf course where Essex Green is today. The shopping center. That was a golf course for many years, and it wasn't until 1955 when that land was developed and changed into from a golf course into the shopping center that is there today. I believe it opened in 1957. There also was a driving range a little bit down Prospect Avenue. Of course, everyone knows, or everyone should know, where Powell's Cabin was. That's on the corner of Prospect and Eagle Rock Avenue. There's a CVS there now. But where the shopping plaza across the street is, that was known as Powell's driving range, associated with Powell's Cabin, and there that for from late 1950s until the early 1960s, when it actually became a shopping center, that was a driving range.
And Powell's Cabin is something we're gonna have to dedicate an episode to, right? There's plenty of history behind
that. There's a lot to talk about with Powell's Cabin, how it formed in the 1930s. You would be surprised to know who actually got their start at Powell's Cabin when they launched.
Give it away now.
Okay, I won't give it away now.
But pretty cool that you could own an establishment. Powell's Cabin, it was a restaurant, right?
That's correct.
And make the decision that you're also going to open up a driving range as well. It's nice to have a nice option to have.
Right. Well, the Horn family came to own a lot of that land. And as I understand it, I don't know this to be fact, and I like to deal in facts, but I believe that even with the shopping center, that they leased the land for 99 years. So they didn't sell the land. They leased the land on a 99-year lease to a holding company, I believe. And I may have something fouled up here with the facts, but I don't believe that the land was ever sold.
All right, that makes sense. Well, getting back to the polo.
So, yeah, so polo was the banner sport, the original banner sport of the Essex County Country Club. And one of the best polo players in West Orange for many years was a man by the name of T.H. Powers Farr. Thomas Powers Farr, F-A-R-R was his last name. And he was the first president of the First National Bank in West Orange. I mentioned earlier the PNC Bank. When that bank first opened, he was the bank's president. And he was a very famous polo player. He had gone to Princeton University, played polo at Princeton University, was a member of one of the founding members of the Essex County Country Club, and played polo for many years. But in...
his name was T.H. Power?
Yeah, Thomas... I don't know what the H stood for. Powers Farr.
Farr, okay.
Yeah, F-A-R-R was his last name.
Yeah, if you're going to be a banker and good at polo, that's probably the only name that you could have.
Yeah, I would imagine so. Mr. Farr was the driving force behind the founding of Rock Spring in 1925. Now, although he was a founding member of Essex County, of the Essex County Country Club, he was unhappy that they were serving liquor. And he wanted to find, he wanted to start a country club that did not serve liquor. And that is really the genesis for the founding of the Rock Spring Country Club when it opened in 1925.
Is this prohibition related?
Mr. Farr had stated to an acquaintance, Stanley Bobson, I believe was his name, that he wanted to find a country club with a wholesome family atmosphere. And I guess that may have been lacking at the Essex County Country Club. I don't know that it was, but the key difference was that they served liquor at the Essex County Country Club, and Farr was not interested in that. And that's what kind of caused him to break off and start the ball in motion for the founding of Rock Spring. And by the way, Rock Spring Country Club derives its name from the Rock Spring that was on Northfield Avenue. I have some of the early newsletters from the Rock Spring Country Club, and it clearly states in there that, you know, it was, in fact, the newsletter was Rock Spring Bubbles was the name, and the bubbles come from the fact that it was the spring water of the Rock Spring on Northfield Avenue, and that's where it took its name from.
But there's no actual spring still there. Is that correct?
There is a water company there, and I'm not sure exactly of the process, but for many years, there actually was a spring there that they were taking the water and bottling it. And it was the Rock Spring Water Company, actually. So at Rock Spring today, when you go in there, you'll see a lake on the property, and that it's known as Cable Lake. And before it was, before the golf course was even conceived, it was the cable road that came up from the Orange Valley on Valley Road up to where the tennis courts were at Rock Spring Country Club. And there was a powerhouse at the top of the inclined plane that actually pulled the cable cars up and down. And there was a steam-powered generator in there. And that steam-powered generator, any steam boiler needs a water source. And I believe that the water source for that boiler was Cable Lake, which is just a short distance away. And then that's where the name Cable Lake comes from. I have seen older newspaper articles that refer to it as Matthew's Pond. I'm not sure where that came from, but it does indicate that it was a small pond there to begin with. And when it was taken over by the Rock Spring Country Club, they had to dredge the lake, and there was tree stumps that were found. Many tree stumps had to be removed from the lake, Cable Lake. But over the years, Cable Lake also has served as recreational use in the 1930s, 1940s. Carteret School in West Orange used it for ice hockey, in addition to Crystal Lake. So Cable Lake has served as recreational use.
It's also a consumer of golf balls from my end.
Well, I was recently told that when Crystal Lake, of course, Crystal Lake is not Cable Lake, but it's often, the two are often confused. Crystal Lake is further down Prospect Avenue. It's right across from where, what we talked about earlier, where Powell's Cabin was.
With their driving range, and also right near where the bowling alley was.
And when Crystal Lake was dredged, there was a total of 57 bowling balls that were pulled out of the bottom of Crystal Lake, which comes as no surprise.
That's a really bad shot.
Well, not only is it a bad shot, I think it illustrates the frustration of many bowlers who came out of the bowling alley across the way and decided that they were done with bowling and tossed their bowling ball into Crystal Lake.
Man, anyone that has a bad game of bowling and throws their ball into a lake, that is a hero of mine.
You know, PK, I've been trying to talk and think at the same time, which is obviously difficult for me. when we were talking about polo before, you had mentioned cricket. And I said, yeah, cricket. I went along with it. But I think you meant croquet, not cricket.
Yeah, that would make a little more sense.
Yeah, croquet was the game where you would play in the backyard, where you'd have the mallet and you'd hit the ball along the ground. And cricket is an English game, much more like baseball, I think. So before, when you mentioned cricket, that was kind of in my mind there that you really mentioned, you really meant croquet, not cricket.
All that being said, polo is like croquet on horses.
Yes, yes, right? Exactly. And that's what we were going for there, polo. You know, I lived in Argentina as an exchange student, and they play polo there. And that was the only time I've ever seen polo played other than on TV. And it is an intense sport.
How long were you in Argentina for?
I was in there for 6 to 8 weeks in 1993. I was on assignment with a Rotary International as part of a group study exchange. They took six people from a Rotary district here in New Jersey and exchanged them with six people in a Rotary district in Argentina. So it was quite the experience.
Oh, very interesting.
It was, and we could do a whole show dedicated to that. But
add it to the resume.
Add it to the resume. You know, I talked about caddying earlier, and I want to really go back to that. My father, you know, during the Depression, it was really the first job he and a lot of his friends had. That, you know, caddying was the only really way to make money. And he would caddy at Essex Fells and Crestmont, but mostly at Essex Fells. And, you know, I caddied at Essex County Country Club. Now, I think my father used to tell me that they would make $1 a bag for a loop. A round of golf was often referred to a loop by caddies, and they would make $1 a bag. And that was a lot of money back then. But in the early 1970s, when I was caddying, I was making if you carried a single bag, that was $7. If you carried a double bag, which I usually did because I was husky, so I would carry two bags, and that was $14 for 18 holes.
By husky, you mean strong in stature.
By husky, I mean strong. And when we went shopping for pants at Robert Hall's, my mother would take me to the husky rack. But yeah, no, it was quite a grueling task. It seemed like I was making a lot of money then when I was making $14 plus a $2 tip. Plus, after 9 holes, we got a soda from the bar that they bought for us. So we didn't know any better, but we were doing good. And in comparison to what my father made during the 1930s, it certainly was better. I don't know what caddies get now, but I think they're in excess of $100. And
but if you were caddying in the 70s, was Caddyshack the film a good representation of what you experienced?
Well, that didn't come out till later, but I often said that the movie Caddyshack, if anybody's ever seen it, for anyone like myself who has ever really caddied, the movie is a documentary. Okay, it's not a. It really depicts what life was at a country club from a caddy's perspective. So yeah, it's. It obviously has comical aspects to it, but in my mind, it always has been a documentary in the sense that all the subplots of that movie really existed to some degree on the golf course, and I would venture to say always will.
I never saw a Snickers bar the same after I saw that movie.
I think you're not alone in that regard. But I also want to come back to a story. You mentioned earlier that you played golf, and according to the United States Golf Association Rules of Golf, Rule Number 13 states, a ball must be played as it lies. Now, did you ever hear of winter rules and summer rules?
I think in essence, in the winter, it's a little more player-friendly since the course conditions aren't as great.
At least at the Essex County Country Club, when I was caddying there, at the beginning of the season, I guess late April, early May, when the weather was good enough where you can go out, it was what they called winter rules. And that means if your ball was in the rough, that you were permitted to go and pick the ball up and drop it over your shoulder to get a better lie in the rough, because the weather really didn't permit the proper maintenance of the roughs. So one of the first golfers I was caddying, that was still carrying a single bag, and it was Dr. Walsh, I'll never forget his name. He picked the ball up during winter rules and dropped it over his shoulder. And not knowing the distinction between winter rules and summer rules, I was trying to be a good caddy. And I went and I picked the ball up and handed it back to him. And he just kind of looked at me, and because it cost him a stroke. He was very polite and explained it to me, and I certainly never forgot that. But I'm sure you've heard the golf term mulligan.
Oh, yes. More than familiar with that one. I'd say it's one of the first terms that you learn when you start to golf.
And the aforementioned rule number 13 states that a ball must be played as it lies. This rule essentially prohibits the golfer from moving the ball in the fairways to reposition it for a better shot. Now, like golf, many pastimes have unofficial rules and other traditions not found in the rule book. The same is true of golf. One such custom agreed upon by golfers is universally known as the mulligan. It's a second drive allowed as a courtesy by other golfers in the group, and it usually occurs when a player hits a bad first shot off the tee to start the hole. Now, how many times have we done that? You know, you hit a bad shot, and you want everyone to kind of have a good start off the hole, and so it's a common practice between players, and the term mulligan is well known and used throughout the golfing world. Although it's mostly associated with golf, it has now become synonymous with any time a person gets a second chance at something. We call it a mulligan. Well, how do you think the term mulligan originated?
A bad golfer, that's for sure. Probably a caddy, right? It had to have been a caddy.
Well, you're not far off base on that. And there are a few competing stories, and you can look them up on the internet. One version of the term mulligan, of the origin of the term mulligan, relates to a former West Orange resident, John A. Buddy Mulligan, who grew up in West Orange during the 1930s. Now, he was a locker room attendant and a caddy at the Essex Fells Country Club during the same time that my father was a caddy there. Now, my father never mentioned Buddy Mulligan by name, but I'm sure that he knew him, as all the caddies probably did. Because Buddy was a locker room attendant, he didn't have time. Caddies always got to play on the golf course, but Buddy Mulligan didn't have time to play or practice. So he often played 18 holes with the assistant pro at the time was Dave O'Connell and a reporter named Des Sullivan. They usually played together towards the end of the day after Mulligan finished cleaning the locker room. And there were very few members still out on the golf course, and that's usually when the caddies would go out on the golf course. So as the West Orange story goes, Mulligan hit a terrible shot off of the first tee with a round of golf with O'Connell and Sullivan. And he didn't like the shot, so he asked if he could take a second shot and forget the first one, since he was working all morning and didn't have an opportunity to warm up like the two of them. They felt sorry for him, and they permitted Mulligan his request, but never dreamed of the long-term effects it would have, because Mulligan's second shot became known as the mulligan. And O'Connell eventually became the golf pro, and Sullivan became the golf editor for the Newark Evening News and often used the term in his golf articles. And a couple years ago, I was actually investigating the story. And if you go to the Essex Fells Country Club, there's actually a plaque on the first tee to Buddy Mulligan that recounts the story at the precise location where the term mulligan was born. Now, as I say, there's other competing stories on the internet, but the West Orange mulligan story is the one that seems to have the most traction and the most plausibility.
Well, thank you, Buddy Mulligan. That was his name, right? Buddy Mulligan?
Yeah, John A. Buddy Mulligan. He was locker room attendant. And, you know, it's a good thing that his name was Mulligan and not O'Malley, because we would be referring to it as give me an O'Malley or whatever his surname would have been. So Mulligan, Buddy Mulligan gave us the term Mulligan. And as I say, there's competing stories, but I like the West Orange story.
I'm going to stick with that one, too.
So as we draw this episode to an end, there's one other thing. Crestmont Country Club. I also caddied in later years at the Crestmont Country Club, and Yogi Berra used to have tournaments there. It was like a member guest fundraising type thing. And although years earlier I caddied at Essex County Country Club, I kind of migrated to the Crestmont Country Club to participate as a caddy in these member guest tournaments. And my biggest claim to fame, I guess, would be that I got to caddy for Phil Rizzuto. Now, none of the other caddies wanted Phil Rizzuto because they said he was a bad tipper. And that didn't really bother me. I just wanted to caddy for Phil Rizzuto. I thought it would be really cool to listen to him for 18 holes on the golf course. So I caddied for Phil Rizzuto, and at the end of the loop, he actually gave me a $20 tip, and I thought that was pretty cool. And certainly I got a couple autographs from him and everything. And so Phil Rizzuto was a pretty good golfer too.
$20 is a pretty good tip.
Good tip considering I was accustomed to like a $2 tip, right. You know, at Essex County Country Club. So I forget what the fee was to carry a single golf bag, although I think I carried two that day. But it didn't matter. I was really starstruck, you might say, because I was caddying for Phil Rizzuto.
Well, that actually reminds me of one of my favorite yogiisms. You know, Yogi Berra, very famous for quotes. And my favorite yogiism is, it ain't over until it's over. So on that note, our episode is wrapping up here. So we are going to have to transition over to our Farmer's Almanac joke. So let me hand you the cold copy.
Wow, it gets early late around here, or late early around here. This is the first time I am seeing this, as is the custom. So this is from the Farmer's Almanac, and it says, a tour bus driver is driving with a busload of seniors down a highway when he was tapped on the shoulder by a little old lady. She offers him a handful of peanuts, which he gratefully munches up. After about 15 minutes, she taps him on the shoulder again, and she hands him another handful of peanuts. She repeats this gesture about 5 more times. When she is about to hand him another batch again, he asks the little old lady, "Why don't you eat the peanuts yourself?" "We can't chew them because we have no teeth," she replied. The puzzled driver asks, "Why do you buy them then?" The old lady replied, "We just love the chocolate around them." I can certainly relate to that. Who doesn't love the chocolate around the peanuts? This was from the Farmer's Almanac.
That was a good one. Yeah.
They're getting better. I'll say that. You know, next time I see an old lady with no teeth, eating peanuts, I'm going to wonder where the chocolate went.
All right, Joe. Well, we covered a lot today. At least 5 different golf courses and a few caddy stories.
We covered a lot. We were all over the board. I was kind of babbling along here, but there's a lot to try to tie together here.
Well, that's the beauty of our show, is you have to piece together things yourselves. And remember, if you have any questions, concerns, comments, just go to our website, roadsofhome.com, write into us and let us know what you think. So, Joe, let me throw it over to you for the big, hard out.
This is Joe Fagan with PK in studio here. Thank you for joining us on this episode of The Roads of Home. Join us on the journey, and we'll see you on The Roads of Home.